As you may remember, at the end of part one, the young Baron Deathmortz, the baddest astronomer in the world, threatened Jodrell Banks School of Astronomy and Astrophysics' radio astronomy data with a microwave oven. Luckily, our heroes had a plan to stop him.
We've got to think of something.
Let's hope that caretaker doesn't do something stupid.
Step away from the microwave or I'll fire.
That's it. Prepare to lose your data.
Lento frequento.
And after that spell was cast, the professors of astronomy and defense against the dark matter were able to debunk his bad astronomy and he fled, weakened. However, he was not destroyed, and over the course of the summer holidays, acts of bad astronomy started to appear in the Muggle world. Nick, Stuart and Megan are now in their second year at Jodrell.
I'd rather be out practicing Quidditch than doing this astronomy homework.
Yeah, Nick, I wasn't paying that much attention either.
You two really should be revising more. You've been spending far too much time worrying about that rumour that he who must not
Baron
be named
Deathmortz
is trying to open the Chamber of Anti-Science. And, by the way, Europa is covered in ice, not mice.
Blimey! Thanks, Megan. I don't know what we'd do without you.
Anyway, Stuart, I think we really need to practice defense against dark matters if we're going to stop Deathmortz from doing something terrible like releasing a secret Armageddon. I borrowed this old book from the University of Manchester Library. Someone with the initials PP has scribbled notes in the margins making great suggestions for fighting anti-science claims.
Is it peer-reviewed by the Minister of Astronomy? You had better be careful, it may be dangerous.
It all seems pretty reasonable to me. And it even has interviews with real astronomers. Let me try one. Acasio Jodcastus.
The Jodcast. Already taking travel bookings for sun, sulfur and saunas in the hottest alien spires in the galaxy. With Nick Rattenbury, Stuart Lowe and David Ault. The Jodcast. July Extra Edition.
Hello there, and welcome to the July Extra edition of the Jodcast. Nick and I are here to guide you through this issue. So, hello, Nick.
Hey, hi, hi, Dave.
So, what have we got on this issue? Well, we've got Matt Burley, who is talking about white dwarfs and extrasolar planets. We'll hear all of your reviews in iTunes. And we've also got Ask an Astronomer with me and Nick. So, Nick, tell us all about white dwarfs.
Our sun will eventually evolve into a white dwarf, a highly compact object that will spend billions of years slowly cooling. I spoke with Dr. Matt Burley from the University of Leicester about his search for planets around white dwarfs.
My background is in white dwarf stars, which I did my PhD in, and amongst the things I did in my PhD was look at white dwarfs in binary systems, so white dwarfs with companions ranging from A stars down to M dwarfs at a range of separations. Some of them might have been interacting because they're very close and some wide. And from that, I got interested in finding very low mass companions to white dwarfs. So we're talking about brown dwarfs and then perhaps things even lower in mass.
Before we go on, let's talk a little bit about white dwarfs themselves. Can you explain just briefly for us what a white dwarf star is?
So a white dwarf star is basically a dying star. So when the sun eventually runs out of hydrogen fuel that it's currently burning, which will be in about 5 billion years' time, so nothing we have to worry about, the sun will go through a few stages of evolution. It'll first grow up into a what we call a red giant. So it'll expand in radius to around about the same radius as the Earth's orbit. Eventually, the red giant will lose its atmosphere in what we call the planetary nebula stage, and I think many people are familiar with the beautiful pictures of planetary nebula that Hubble produces, for example. And what's left behind after the atmosphere has been ejected is the core of the star, which is collapsing in on itself. And the core collapses to a size about the same size as the Earth, but it packs in about somewhere between half a solar mass and the mass of the sun into that small volume.
So these things are extremely dense then.
These things are extremely dense. You know, I think the typical analogy is that a teacup full of the material that a white dwarf is made from would weigh the same as an elephant. You know, it's incredibly dense material. And that white dwarf star is the dying embers of the star that was once like the sun. And white dwarfs are born very hot, and what they do is just cool down slowly over time. So white dwarfs range in temperature from around 100,000 degrees for the very youngest ones, the ones that have been relatively newborn, down to a few thousand degrees for the oldest ones.
Mm. It's an interesting point, though, because I mean, most people think of a white dwarf, as you say, as the end of an evolution of a star, a dying ember, as you say, and therefore they think, oh, a white dwarf must be quite cool. But you're saying these things are still quite hot, especially if they've just been created.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, very few of them are cooler than the sun. The sun has a temperature of about 5,500 degrees. There's a few white dwarfs cooler than that, but to get to 5,500 degrees takes them more than 10 billion years. I mean, it takes them a long time.
Right.
So, the youngest white dwarfs, say ones that were born within the last few 100 million years, are at temperatures anywhere between 10,000 and 100,000 degrees. So, they're what we call the young white dwarfs, and they cool down in a very steady and well understood way. So actually, white dwarfs are—they're really good clocks for measuring the ages of clusters or the galactic disk, because we think we understand how they cool very well.
So you see a white dwarf with a certain surface temperature, and you think, well, if it was created roughly at the same time as other members of the association it's with, you can time it
exactly. You can tell the age of a stellar cluster from the white dwarfs within it, and the same with the galactic disk. And in the future, we'll be able to do it for extragalactic objects, other galaxies.
Are these white dwarfs actually stars? They differ from normal stars in a very important way.
Well, they were once stars like the sun. We know that. They do not burn hydrogen in their centre in fusion reactions like stars like the sun do. But they are still a star. They are now shining basically because they've collapsed in on themselves and all that heat has to get out slowly. That's what powers them. So, yes, they are stars. There's another kind of star called a brown dwarf, otherwise termed a failed star, because it never reached a high enough mass to start burning hydrogen in the first place in fusion reactions. White dwarfs at least once did burn hydrogen in fusion reactions. So, yeah, they're stars.
So your research now is based around finding companions to these white dwarf stars.
Yeah.
And you mentioned looking for planets around white dwarf stars. Tell me how you do that.
So what we're doing is looking in the infrared for very faint companions to white dwarfs. So we look in the infrared because planets have very low temperatures. The temperature of Jupiter is roughly 300 Kelvin. So the peak of Jupiter's output is in the infrared. So we look in the infrared because that's where planets are expected to be bright. It's also where white dwarfs themselves are actually faint. They're much fainter in the infrared than they are in the optical. So it increases this contrast between the two, gets a lot better. So we're taking infrared images of white dwarfs. We take a pair of images a few years apart, and what we do is we look for an object that happens to be moving with the white dwarf. So all the white dwarfs we're looking at are fairly nearby to the sun. And because they're nearby, they have what we call high proper motions. That means that they appear to be moving quite quickly against background stars, the stars that are further away. And so we can see the white dwarf move against the background stars between our pairs of images. And we look for anything really faint, a really faint infrared source in the field of view that's also moving with the white dwarf.
Now, you're making these observations in infrared because, as you say, the planet is emitting most strongly in the infrared, whereas the white dwarf is not. But it takes us to an interesting point, though. The planet itself is emitting radiation in the infrared. So you're looking for the direct radiation emission from the planet.
Yes.
Not the reflected light.
Absolutely not. No, white dwarfs are, as I said earlier, they're about 10,000 times fainter than something like the sun. And the planets we're looking for are at very wide orbits, much further away in general than the Earth is from the sun. Mm-hmm. So the amount of reflected light is negligible. Now, what we're trying to find is the actual thermal emission from the planet itself. So the kinds of planets we're looking for are gas giants like Jupiter. And it's an interesting fact. Now, I'll try and get my numbers right here, but something like two-thirds of the light you see from Jupiter is internally generated. It's heat that's given off from when Jupiter was formed.
You're talking about infrared, though, the infrared radiation.
Infrared radiation.
Is that right? Two-thirds of it is internally generated?
It's internally generated, so it's left over from when Jupiter formed.
And the remaining one-third is presumably reflected?
It's reflected sunlight.
Oh, I see.
Now, from a planet around a white dwarf, we really expect almost no reflected light components, so it's all internally generated. Mm.
Even though the white dwarf is not emitting strongly in the infrared, surely it must be much, much brighter than the planet in the infrared.
It's still much brighter, yes. But we're talking factors of, say, 10,000, as opposed to the contrast between the Sun and Jupiter is about a factor billion.
Oh, right,
and,
okay.
And also, we're looking for things that are tens of times further away from the white dwarf than the Earth is from the Sun. And, of course, we're looking at nearby white dwarfs, so all these factors together means actually that we're looking for things that are well separated from the white dwarf. We don't have to worry about the contrast. So one of the things we're not doing is using this technique called adaptive optics, where you try to, on very large telescopes, you try to correct for the twinkling of the star, the seeing conditions, to try and resolve very faint companions close in. We don't need to do that. We're looking quite a long way away from the white dwarf.
Right. So you have a set of white dwarves that mm-hmm. you know are white dwarves, and you've observed them in the infrared with what?
We're looking with very large telescopes. So we use the new generation of 8-meter telescopes. Well, they've been around for almost 10 years now. So we're using the VLT, which is run by the European Southern Observatory in Chile. And we use the two Gemini telescopes, which are joint projects between the UK, America, Brazil, Argentina, Australia. So they, one of those is sighted in Chile and one of those is sighted in Hawaii. So one looks at the northern sky, one looks at the southern. So those are the two telescopes we're mainly using. There are one or two other groups around the world trying to do the same thing as us, and they've used the Hubble Space Telescope, they've used the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is NASA's infrared mission. So we're using all the latest facilities and the best instruments.
All the best gear,
and you need to, because and even with those instruments, we're pushing right to the limit of what they can achieve.
Yeah. Well, you're demanding an awful lot, aren't you? You're asking to see something 1/10,000th fainter
yep.
than the main thing you're looking at, the white dwarf.
Yeah, we're asking to find objects as cool as 300 Kelvin. So, I mean, if I can put that into context, the coolest brown dwarf currently known has a temperature of around 700 degrees. And there's a lot of work going on around the world to find brown dwarfs that are cooler. Now, of course, we would expect things lower in mass than a brown dwarf that are old to be at temperatures of, say, less than 500 Kelvin. So we're looking for, in terms of these gas giant planets, we're looking for things between, say, 300 and 500 Kelvin. And, of course, the temperature of the Earth is roughly 330 Kelvin. So we're trying to find things that are...
You're trying to
really
find things
cool.
which have got essentially the same temperature as the Earth.
Yep. The same temperature as Jupiter, that kind of thing. Obviously, things slightly hotter than that will be easier to find, but we're pushing it down to that limit, yeah.
That's remarkable. So you need at least two observations, presumably, for each white dwarf to see whether you've got a little companion.
Yes, because we're looking for something that moves with the same motion as the white dwarf. So we need two observations, and we need at least a year's baseline between the observations to see the motion. In some cases, we need more than a year's baseline. So it's a pretty long-term project.
Why so long? I mean, you need that much time to give things to shift?
Yeah, so some of the white dwarfs we're looking at have got very high proper motions, and so within a space of a few months, they will move quite a few pixels on your detector. So they're easy to spot the motion, and likewise, it's fairly easy to spot the motion of any companions. Other white dwarfs in our sample have smaller velocities, and so you simply have to wait that time for them to move enough pixels on your detector to unambiguously detect the motion, and also importantly to unambiguously detect the motion of anything much fainter.
Right.
It becomes increasingly harder to measure the motions of the fainter things in your images. Yeah.
How many white dwarves are you looking at?
Our current sample is about 40. So we've selected white dwarfs within about 50 light years of the Earth. Mm. We select white dwarfs that are relatively young in white dwarf terms, so we're talking maybe 3 billion years and younger, because anything older, once the white dwarfs get older than that, and their accompanying planets are older than that, they are really too faint to see.
Right.
So we've got the age constraints, we've got the distance constraints, and also, of course, the distance constraint is that you want to separate, easily be able to resolve your planet from the white dwarf, and if you look at things that are further away, then they will become blended together,
right,
just through a distance argument. So.
So how have you done? Have you found any?
No. But what's interesting is the limits. So this is a difficult experiment, and as I said before, we're really pushing these, even the world's largest telescopes, we're really pushing what they can do. But we are getting into a regime where we are sensitive to things of planetary mass. Now, we're not sensitive to things as low in mass as one Jupiter, but we are sensitive to things of a few Jupiters in mass. With our best case white dwarfs, so we have a couple of very young white dwarfs, which are only a few hundred million years old, we think we've been sensitive there to, say, two or three Jupiter masses, and we haven't found anything there. So we can say, with some reasonable confidence, that there are no planets going around those white dwarfs with masses higher than two or three Jupiters. For most of our sample, the limits are a little worse. Between, say, 5 and 10 Jupiters is our limit. So we know that there's nothing more massive than between 5 and 10 Jupiters going around that white dwarf. To draw further conclusions is a bit difficult. We know from the radial velocity surveys, the Doppler wobble surveys of main sequence stars, that although planets as high in mass as 5 to 10 Jupiters do exist, they are rare.
Mm.
So the fact that in a sample of 40 white dwarfs we haven't seen anything with that mass isn't necessarily a surprise.
Right.
We would probably have had to get lucky.
Yeah.
Or you could say we've been slightly unlucky not to detect anything.
Yeah.
So we really need to do two things. We need to expand our sample size, so the number of white dwarfs we look at, and we need to increase our sensitivity. So we need to get, in all cases, we need to be sensitive to, say, 1 to 2 Jupiter masses. Now, unfortunately, to do this, we need bigger telescopes, better instrumentation.
Bigger than an 8-meter telescope? So,
yeah, so we're thinking...
Who are you going to talk to about that?
We're thinking, for example, the European Southern Observatory has a project called the Extremely Large Telescope that it's now kick-started. So this will be a telescope that may be 30 or 40 metres in diameter, a huge behemoth.
It boggles the mind, doesn't it? 30-metre
telescope. It's a huge construction project. And, they're thinking of this thing coming online around 2020.
Right.
And it's a serious project now. It's not just some designer's dream, that ESO have committed themselves to doing it.
So you're going to be first in line to say if you want to use it.
It's certainly something I've put into the science case for that telescope. The other mission that will help us out is the James Webb Space Telescope, which is NASA's follow-on mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, James Webb Space Telescope will look in exclusively in the infrared, and it will operate in space, obviously, quite a long way from the Earth, so that it operates in a very cool region where you can make good infrared measurements. And JWST will be very good for looking at white dwarfs and trying to find much less massive companions to them. Yeah.
Mm.
I have no doubt that one day somebody, hopefully me, will find a planet of some mass going around a white dwarf. And at that stage, you know, that there are two interesting aspects. One is the philosophical thing. One day our sun will turn into a white dwarf. And, you know, it's interesting to speculate what will happen to our solar system, what will happen to the outer planets, the gas giants, what will happen to the Earth. And so by finding planets around white dwarfs, we're effectively looking into our own future.
Yes.
What's going to happen to us. So that's a kind of philosophical thing.
Mm. Presumably the inner planets get eaten up. Well, the red giant stage, I guess.
That's very interesting, because current models, or the latest models for the evolution of the sun, suggest that when the sun hits the red giant stage, it will expand to around the radius of the Earth's orbit. So the Earth will either get destroyed, it'll get swallowed up, or it'll just survive. Mm. But whatever happens, it'll get very hot. And I'm afraid life will not carry on the Earth at that point.
But it might be possible for life to carry on a moon around a planet like Jupiter
or Saturn, yes. And that's a very interesting thing. Mm. So would any civilization that happens to be around there simply migrate to the moons of Jupiter or Saturn? Yeah, exactly. But we fully expect Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune all to survive the red giant stage and to survive to the white dwarf stage. So, once we start finding planets around white dwarfs, we can start to really get constraints on how the solar system will evolve in these future, in the distant future that we're looking at.
Yeah. How long does a star exist in the white dwarf stage?
Well, forever, essentially. Once it's evolved to a white dwarf, it stays, it just cools.
It slowly cools down over time.
Yeah, so the universe itself is around 13 to 15 billion years old. And the oldest white dwarfs are around, we think they're around 3,000 to 4,000 Kelvin in temperature. So over the age of the universe, the first white dwarfs have cooled to that kind of temperature. Mm. They will just carry on cooling. And the older they get, the slower they cool. So,
yeah.
I mean, eventually they will turn into an object, a hypothetical object that you might call a black dwarf, where its temperature is so cool that you essentially can't see it. It's almost at the background temperature of the universe, but the universe will have to be exceptionally old before that happens.
It raises an interesting point, though, because a star like our Sun spends 10 billion years as a star in the main sequence. It goes through a red giant stage and then turns into a white dwarf, and then spends the next, presumably 10 billion years as a white dwarf,
yes,
slowly cooling. So our Sun is a very active object.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's young.
Yes.
It's a natural question to ask, the chances of life around white dwarf stars, if we're going to have lots of these white dwarfs. Mm-hmm. As a natural end to stellar evolution, then we should ask what kind of planets exist around white dwarfs and whether life can exist.
Well, exactly, and the question of life around a white dwarf, look, your first instinct is that the white dwarf is very feeble, it's 10,000 times less luminous than the Sun, and young white dwarfs, because they're hot, they give out a lot of X-rays and a lot of ultraviolet radiation,
right,
which is very damaging for any biosphere, so very damaging for any life on the surface of a planet. So those two things would make it unlikely that advanced life forms and intelligent life would be on any planet around a white dwarf. There are creatures which biologists call extremophiles, so bacteria essentially, which live in very weird environments on Earth. We found these microbial life in lakes underneath the Antarctic ice, in volcanic vents at the bottom of the sea, deep inside rocks. You find life in the most unlikely places. So I don't think it's beyond the bounds of possibility that at least microbial life might exist in rocky objects going around a white dwarf. Advanced life, I guess you could end up speculating that any advanced civilization might try to protect itself by building, there's this concept of these Dyson spheres, isn't there?
Yes.
A bit like the Death Star, where an advanced civilization might build something like that. But I mean, this is pure speculation, but I would have thought that if a civilization was around when it knew its sun was in its last days, it might get on a spaceship and hop off to another stellar system, even if it meant putting yourself in suspended animation or having to breed numerous generations on board before you got there.
But presumably you wouldn't have to go so far, right? You'd say, right, we're all off to Jupiter because that's going to be the next safe neighbourhood when Earth...
When it gets to the red giant stage, maybe, yes. Mm. But once the red giant loses its atmosphere and you're left with a white dwarf, it's going to be very cold out of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to get an escape eventually.
Yeah.
But it's so far in the future. I mean, 5 billion years of evolution, mankind will have evolved into something completely different. So...
Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and we wish you all the best on the hunt for planets around the white dwarfs.
Thank you.
Right, thanks, Nick. And that was a fantastic interview, looking for planets around white dwarfs.
Yes, it's exciting stuff, isn't it?
And especially now that the exoplanets, extrasolar planets, have come back into the news.
Certainly has.
The very recent discovery of a hot Jupiter which has water water vapor.
Yes, indeed. This is news from a group of NASA scientists using the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is a infrared space telescope.
Oh, okay.
And they're looking at a known extrasolar planet system, and the host star has got this fantastic name of HD189733. And
that's memorable.
That's memorable, isn't it? Yes. And the planet is got the name of HD189733b.
Oh.
And this is one of those so-called hot Jupiters. It's a large planet, several times the size of Jupiter, orbiting very, very close to its host star. And using the space telescope Spitzer, these astronomers have discovered the presence of water in the atmosphere of this planet.
Wow, okay. How do you do that, though? How do you find water on a different planet?
Well, basically by taking a look at the light coming from the star through the atmosphere of the planet, and some of that light from the star is going to be absorbed by the planet's atmosphere, and it's through that absorption we actually can figure out what is doing the absorption. So we can discover what is in the planet's atmosphere due to what how it is stopping light from its background star when the planet is transiting in front of that host star.
Right, so it's like having a piece of red gel and holding it in front of a light.
Sure.
It's the light that comes through that tells you that there's a red filter in front of it.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so the water's acting like a filter.
Yeah, a similar sort of idea. I mean, that red gel is preventing anything other than red going through. So. Mm-hmm.
And this water, is it going to be in any usable form?
Well, unfortunately not. Because the planet is orbiting very, very close to its host star, it is awfully hot. And the researchers estimate that the surface temperature gets as much as 930 degrees Celsius on the day side of the planet.
Okay.
So it's rather hot.
Yes.
And so whatever water is in the atmosphere of this planet is going to be steam. It is going to be awfully hot.
Right. But still good for an alien sauna.
Not bad for an alien sauna, that's right.
Okay, right. I'll book tickets now. Okay, so from some fascinating news that's happened very recently to our recent reviews, which have described us as substantive and fascinating.
Yes, fantastic. They have so many wonderful reviews coming in from folk around the world. Thank you to everybody who has reviewed us on iTunes, and do please keep them coming in. So our thanks to all you folk out there who are listening to us, but please, we really need you guys to review us on iTunes to increase our standing and tell your friends.
Definitely, yes. And we've got people from the UK, from the US, and indeed from Australia.
Yes, so hello to all our listeners in Australia. We know that there is at least one. So our thanks go to all of those people who have reviewed us since our last call for reviews, and they are Fura, www.ikthud.com.
That's great.
Ikthud. Someone from the Redditch Astronomical Society, Mike Hatfield, Sky Pilot, and Clinton Huxley.
Yes, who drives past Jodrell Bank on the way to work.
Yes.
And the Lovell telescope never fails to inspire awe. It's just too big. That's very true. And I had it in my back garden for a year, which was great fun.
And indeed, my office overlooks the Lovell telescope, so it's quite nice to see that working away, looking at the sky.
Now we move on to Ask an Astronomer.
Yes, indeed. We've had quite a few questions coming on in, and thank you very much to everybody who was asking their questions. If you do want to ask your questions, always please just go to www.jodcast.net and follow the links to the query pages, send us your questions, and we'll answer some of them on the Jodcast.
And of course, you can leave your feedback there. If you don't have iTunes, you can leave your feedback with us on the website.
Yes.
So do send us an email through that.
All feedback is gratefully, gratefully appreciated. Please let us know what you like about the Jodcast, what you don't like, how we can improve. Mm-hmm. We're always looking at how we can improve ourselves.
Even if it is just telling us that we need weekly shows of an hour long. Which has been a call so far.
I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon because
there's only three of us.
Yes.
But certainly do send us suggestions for people that you'd like us to interview.
Yes, indeed. If you've got some people in mind who you'd like us to go and interview, then please do suggest them and we will see what we can do.
And also, if you are an astronomical society, we have something that you might be interested in. Nick?
Yes, indeed. I mean, we've got a 30-second plug, which we've decided to pilot on the Jodcast. You've got 30 mm-hmm. seconds to describe who you are, where you are, what you do, and anything else about your astronomical society, and we will broadcast that on the Jodcast. So please, if you've got even the most modest recording equipment, please do record 30 seconds about you and your astronomical society.
And so back to Ask an Astronomer, but unfortunately Tim is on holiday at the moment, so you're stuck with just the two of us
right, still.
So, Nick, are you ready to answer some questions, to be on the receiving end of the questions?
Fire away.
Right. So here's just a quick question for you to start off. It's from Ed Norrie, and he says, with so much of the universe near to our solar system having been mapped and the professionally built and manned telescopes always on the lookout, is there much chance of self-funded amateur astronomers discovering new planets or bodies?
Well, I think the answer to this is twofold. Finding other planets, possibly not, because we like to think that we've found all the planets around our solar system mm-hmm. that is within the reach of an amateur telescope. However, yes, there's always a chance that you're going to discover something which the big professional astronomy observatories have missed. In fact, some of the more famous comet hunters are doing their best work with a simple 6-inch telescope and their dedication and their enthusiasm. They're out there pretty much every clear night scanning the skies. They know the sky backwards. They can see something new and identify it immediately as something new. And this is how these discoveries are made. So you can make these, you know, fascinating discoveries of near Earth objects, comets, using very modest equipment. A 6-inch telescope is going to be fine.
I think it's fair to say that even with all of the telescopes that there are across the world, there's still a lot of sky that is left unlooked at.
That's right. I mean, the big professional observatories do tend to focus their surveys towards interesting regions of the sky, interesting to them for their own research goals. Mm. But there's a definite move towards trying to monitor the entire sky. However, that's done with, again, fairly modest equipment, and there's always a chance that they're going to miss something. There's always a chance that you with your modest telescope could be out there, right place, right time, looking in the right direction and see something new.
Okay, so here's your main question about acceleration due to gravity.
Right.
And this is something that comes up quite often with the ideas of zero gravity and such things. It's from Joe Jones, and he says, I have a handbook that has a table giving the acceleration due to gravity at intermediate altitudes above the surface of the Earth between 0 and 1,000 kilometers. The acceleration figure for an altitude of 0 meters is 9.8 meters per second squared, which is what we usually use, and that for 1,000 kilometers is 7.32 meters per second squared, a reduction of just 2.5 meters per second squared. So that's the numbers, but when we see pictures of astronauts on the International Space Station a mere 330 or so kilometers above the Earth, they're floating around more or less weightless. And that's within that 1,000 kilometers. So acceleration due to gravity should be about 8, according to that sort of figure that he sent us in. What is going on here? Is my handbook wrong?
Well, I don't think I'm going out on a limb here by saying that no, the handbook is not wrong. Gravity has not turned itself off. There's a difference between something appearing to be weightless, as in astronauts on the International Space Station in orbit around the Earth, and something in a region where gravity is not operational, where there is no gravity. Now, in the case of the International Space Station, gravity is still operational. The gravity due to the Earth is indeed 7.32 whatever meters per second towards the center of the Earth, and that's indeed why the International Space Station is in orbit. Gravity is pulling the space station constantly towards the center of the Earth. That's why the orbit is circular and it is going around the Earth. Now, the thing is, the space station and the astronauts are in free fall. It's a technical term for everything being falling towards the Earth constantly, but it is going at a velocity, a forward velocity, such that you could think of it that the surface of the Earth is falling away.
Is it fair to say that the space station is moving along, it's trying to fall towards the Earth, but it keeps missing?
Basically. That's one way of thinking about it, yes. The space station and the astronauts contained inside it is being pulled towards the center of the Earth due to gravity. However, the forward velocity means that it's basically shooting past the Earth at the same time.
And just missing.
And missing, yes.
The way I always remember it being explained to me is, if you throw a ball, then it'll land. If you throw it harder, then it'll go further and land back on the Earth. Throw it harder again. And then you can throw it at just the right speed so that it'll be trying to fall towards the Earth and missing.
That's right. Because the Earth is a sphere, eventually the ball will disappear over the horizon, forever being pulled towards the center of the Earth. But the Earth is curving away from the ball's flight at the same rate as the ball is being pulled towards the center of the Earth. And then essentially you are in orbit. If we talk about a lift falling towards the... falling, well, the lift cable breaks and you're falling towards the center of the Earth, a very, very long lift shaft, then the lift is falling towards the center of the Earth, you're falling towards the center of the Earth. You are essentially weightless.
Professor Stephen Hawking went up in a plane and went on one of these what's called parabolic flights, where you climb to a very high altitude and then the plane just drops and...
It basically falls out of the sky, essentially.
Falls out of the sky, and you have that experience of weightlessness.
Right.
And it's how sometimes people are trained, or how people are given that feeling of weightlessness.
So how long can the plane be in free fall before it has to stop and then turn back up again and start becoming a plane rather than a rock?
30 seconds or something. It's enough for you to get that feeling of what it's like to be on board the space station.
Wow, fantastic.
Okay, well, thanks, Nick, for answering those questions.
My pleasure.
And unfortunately, that brings us to the end of this issue of the Jodcast. Coming up next month, we have an interview with Dr. Martin Bureau.
Yes, I talk with Dr. Martin from Oxford about galactic evolution. I mean, we know what galaxies all are, these, you know, lovely island universes full of stars and what have you. But they evolve just like stars, just like planets, solar systems, like everything else in the universe. So they change over time, and we're going to talk to Dr. Martin Bure about that.
Excellent. And from galaxies and their evolution to galaxies and actually spotting them, we'll be talking to Dr. Chris Lintott about Galaxy Zoo, getting people like you, people listening to the Jodcast, people who are just interested in astronomy, to help categorize galaxies.
Yeah, how cool is that? You can professional astronomy at home.
I have signed up, and I've already categorized a couple of galaxies. So
really,
I'm doing my bit. Yeah, yeah, that's great fun.
So what do you do basically? Go on, give us a preview. So, give us a teaser.
Well, the galaxies that they are trying to look at fall into different categories. They're either elliptical or spiral, going clockwise or anti-clockwise, or the pictures that they have are just completely unrecognizable. And what you have to do is go through the tutorial, learn how to recognize a spiral, learn how to recognize an elliptical, and learn how to press the don't know button. and just, you sit there and you look at the galaxies and use your own initiative, you use your discretion to say, yes, that's an elliptical, that's a spiral, or that's someone cleaning the face of the telescope.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
and we'll learn more about that next month.
Definitely. And, of course, at the beginning of the month, we have The Night Sky with Ian Morrison telling you what to see in August. So, thanks then to Nick.
My pleasure. It's always fun.
So, as I said, that brings us to the end of the issue, and we will be back on the 1st of August with the next edition. Do keep your feedback coming in. Keep your emails coming. Keep your questions coming for Ask an Astronomer. Until August, goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody, and thank you very much for listening.
And so the school year progressed, but we'll fast forward through all the teenage angst and misunderstandings and other stuff like that to exam time, when, as usual, Nick, Stuart and Megan find themselves in great danger. Baron Deathmortz has opened the Chamber of Anti-Science, and Lepus's monster is prowling through the school, stupefying students.
Quick, in here. It's a bit dark in here. Luminous Planetarium! Oh my gosh.
Baron Deathmortz!
How did you survive?
After you uncovered me masquerading as a student, you thought you had destroyed me, but I was able to keep part of my bad science soul alive by spreading it across several hoaxes. I slowly gained a large following and was able to rebuild my bodily form. Now my bad astronomy will destroy you all!
We can't fight him alone.
Gosh! The old book! It's glowing!
Blimey! A figure's rising out of it!
I recognize him from the Defense Against Dark Matter's lessons. It's the Great Aura of Phil Plate.
That's right, Nick. I was only a postdoc the first time Baron Deathmortis was at large, but I remember my review of Armageddon as if it were yesterday. I swore right then I would help in the fight against bad astronomy wherever it appeared, so I wrote myself into this book.
Well, we've listened to plenty of astronomy podcasts this year, so together we just might be able to destroy Deathmortis.
A great battle scene ensued with lots of fancy CGI effects. Now, they're really cool. We spent a lot on them. Sorry. Nick released podcast after podcast, but as Megan Stewart and the Spirit of Phil Plate issued a combined deconfusion charm against Deathmortis, Nick was struck by a glancing blow by a stray spell. He awoke several days later in the hospital wing.
What happened?
It was fantastic! We think we got him, Nick!
Although some of him might have still survived, we don't know if we destroyed all the hoaxes.
Not to worry. I've restarted the Order of the Skeptics to keep an eye on things, so there shouldn't be too much to worry about for now. Anyway, you have a lot of those get-well presents, Nick. Do you mind if I have one of those all-flavor beans?
Help yourself.
Ugh! Moon dust flavor.
Now, if you two don't mind, I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed, or worse, expelled.
In that intro and outro of the Jodcast, John Morgan was Baron Deathmortis, Captain John Tadrazak was the caretaker, Ara Pelody was Nick, Paula Cartwright was Stuart, Robin Carlyle was Megan, and Phil Plate was himself. No attempt has been made to supersede or infringe any existing copyright relating to Harry Potter, which of course remains the property of J.K. Rowling and Bloomsbury Publishing.
On a different note, are you a composer? One of the requests from our feedback is to have more incidental music in the Jodcast, and so we'd like to turn to you, our audience. If you have some free PodSafe music at all, or would like to compose some, then please let us know, whether it be short stings or music beds. So please get in touch with us at the website at www.jodcast.net. So until the 1st of August, goodbye.